Disrupt is actually one of my pet peeve words. I don't like the way it's usually used in healthcare. This is not the same thing as disrupting, you know, a shopping experience. You have to be able to understand, you know, what is mission critical in the system that I'm trying to change.
I'm Scott McGrew. Welcome to Sand Hill Road.
Achieving a gorgeous grin from home isn't a total mystery with BiteClear aligners. Just don't be surprised if all of your sleuthing friends start asking, "What's your secret?" Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. BiteClear aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Angie's List is now Angie, and we've heard a lot of theories about why.
I thought it was an eco move. Fewer words, less paper.
No, it was so you could say it faster.
No, it's to be more iconic.
Must be a tech thing.
But those aren't quite right. It's because now you can compare upfront prices, book a service instantly, and even get your project handled from start to finish.
Sounds easy.
It is, and it makes us so much more than just a list. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I. Or download the app today.
That's really empowering, right? Because now if you're an engineer and you're trying something, you don't have to like get approval of a bunch of different layers of management. You just go try something, and then when it works, you, here, it worked.
That's Mark Zuckerberg talking to TechCrunch in 2013 about his attitude, move fast and break things. Move fast has been a Silicon Valley philosophy for years, and it's worked. It's led to massively publicly traded companies like Facebook and Uber, and solidified the strategy, take risks, and in Uber's case, break laws in order to grow. Now, you cannot do that with healthcare startups.
There is a real tension, I think, between kind of this, you know, move fast, break things, Silicon Valley, you know, stereotype, right? Which I think at this point, it really is a stereotype. I think Silicon Valley is really trying to break out of that. But also the Hippocratic Oath of healthcare, right? The foundation of healthcare, first do no harm.
That's Greg Yap, investor at Menlo Ventures. He's an expert in healthcare startups.
There are, as you said, a lot of rules in healthcare, right? You've got privacy rules around HIPAA. You've got the FDA regulating what people.
Well, not only are there rules around healthcare, but I mean there are rules around taxi cabs in San Francisco. But violating them is, you know, it's San Francisco probably takes it seriously. It's not the end of the world. Uber broke a couple of rules and is a multi-billion-dollar company. HIPAA and federal rules are really ironclad, and the feds are not messing around.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. And I think it is, you know, there are consequences to be paid. I think people violate those rules at their peril, right? And I think there are different consequences to different kinds of rules, right? I think if you violate FDA, right, I think the crackdown is very severe. Right? I think in this era, I think there have been a lot of violations on privacy, right? A lot of issues with how privacy in healthcare is done. But as you say, there are real consequences to that.
Yap is an investor in Clear Labs, Delphi Diagnostics, Senti Biosciences, and Vital Labs, among others. He's got 20 years experience as an executive in the life sciences.
I think the key issue is that they have to understand the system that they're coming into, right? You always have to understand your customer, right? But in many spaces outside of healthcare, that the customer is a simpler, who is your customer is a simpler question to answer, right? In healthcare, you have to understand your end user, you have to understand the physician, you have to understand the regulator, the payer. I think if you don't understand the situation that you're coming in, then you come in at your own peril, right? Then you're likely to break something that's mission critical, right? When you mentioned the word disrupt. Disrupt is actually one of my pet peeve words. I don't like the way it's usually used in healthcare, because if you disrupt someone's healthcare, they could die, right? This is not the same thing as disrupting, you know, a shopping experience, right? You have to, where the consequences of that are a lot less severe. You have to be able to understand, you know, what is mission critical in the system that I'm trying to change, right? And how do I avoid trying to change too many mission critical things all at the same time?
Do most of the startups you invest in understand that tension, that they have to follow the rules
Yeah, well, so that's the big limiter in how many startups that I invest in, frankly, right? I see a lot of great technologies that can have a real impact in outcomes in healthcare. The place that most of them are lacking, and the reason why, you know, I'm always looking to try to put more money into the space is understanding of the business model context, understanding of the market in which they operate. You know, that's been the big challenge for me in healthcare. I mean, having spent 20 years in this space, I at least have some idea where the landmines are. I certainly don't know where all the landmines are. But when I see a company that doesn't have that, that isn't to the level where they understand some of the issues that they're going to face, you know, it's something I can't afford.
Give me an example of an issue, and you said understand the marketplace. What are you know, maybe they not understanding?
I mean, the hardest part in healthcare, frankly, is getting paid. Right. I mean, all these new technologies, you know, even if they can provide a customer benefit, you know, what is the return on investment to the different stakeholders? Right. The patient may have a better outcome, but the physician that's treating them, are they financially incented to prescribe? Right. Does the payer get a benefit given how long that a given patient is likely to stay with their employer and therefore with that insurer? You know, is this something that requires a enormous amount of clinical data to get to regulatory approval, right? I think one of the challenges for me as an investor is that I can only invest in a small number of companies. And so companies that have wonderful technology, but really haven't thought through those issues deeply enough, right? Or can't answer some of the questions that they're likely to face. It's impossible to.
If I'm a startup, that's kind of frustrating to hear. If I'm the startup, you're the investor. You know, hey, look, I've got this amazing thing that does this amazing, has this amazing outcome. And you're saying, yeah, but who's paying for it?
Yeah. Well, you know, I think they're getting it from every investor, right? Hopefully from
every investor. Well, yeah, I'm sure. But it's just think, hey, look, I have this thing that cures something.
Yeah.
And a logical question from an investor is, yeah, but where are we going to make money on that?
Yes. And so I'm trying to start up a new initiative that is kind of half interactive workshop, half peer community, you know, to try to help some of these entrepreneurs at a little greater scale, right? I can only work with, in my day job, I can only work with one entrepreneur at a time, right? But the idea of getting a group of entrepreneurs together, getting people from these customers who are frustrated themselves at getting pitched by startups that don't understand, you know, that they, you know, a hospital system profit margin is so low, you know, what is the amount of revenue that I'd need to generate from your technology for it to be worth my adoption? You know, some of these, you know, fundamental issues, you know, the customers are also frustrated, right, by having startups approach them with something that's whiz-bang but doesn't align with their business realities. And so that's one of the things that I'd love to do, is to try to help some of these entrepreneurs more at scale. I can only invest in a small number of them, but, you know, maybe there's a way to improve the quality of digital health business models.
Delve into the shadows of the mind with Sleeping Dogs, a gripping murder mystery starring Academy Award winner Russell Crowe. Now available on digital. Crowe portrays an ex-homicide detective unraveling a brutal murder he can't recall. Uncovering secrets from his past, he learns a chilling truth. It's best to let sleeping dogs lie. Visit sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery to watch Sleeping Dogs, now on digital. That's sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery.
CarMax is putting peace of mind back in car shopping by putting you in the driver's seat to find a ride that's right for you. Because at CarMax, we believe you shouldn't just settle for a car. You should love your car. That's why every car we sell is CarMax certified quality, so you can be sure, with upfront pricing that's the same for every customer. So don't settle. Find love at first drive and start shopping now at CarMax.com. CarMax, the way car buying should be.
I have a friend who's a beer distributor, and he was explaining to me how even a bar works. You think the bar buys the beer and then sells it to the customer. It's way more complex than that. And healthcare's got to be just infinitely more complex. You think it is, person goes to doctor, gets treatment, insurance company pays doctor, that's the end of the story. But it is, there are so many intricacies that if you're going to be involved in a healthcare startup, that you have to understand.
Yeah, that's one of the big things that I'm that I focus on, you know, companies that I think are going to be disruptive in the right sense of the word, you know, is ones that where they can find an underserved part of the population and serve them more simply, right? That's actually the original definition of disruptive innovation. A lot of people misuse disruption, right? But when Clayton Christensen, the guy who coined the term, the idea was to find an underserved portion of the market and give them something simple. It doesn't have to be a whiz bang, fancy technology, something noisy and sexy. It has to be something that's simple for a group that isn't getting served by the incumbents, right? And that's the kind of disruption that I'm interested in, right? How do you find something that you can make it simple, right? Because the healthcare system, as you said, is really complex, right? How can you make it simpler for, you know, niches in healthcare can be really big. And so how can you find something that's simpler for some subset of that system and really, you know, take the pain out of it for them?
I have a plan that shows how we can have Medicare for all without raising taxes 1 cent on middle class families.
I would think one of the biggest risks about being an investor in healthcare startups would be the absolutely unclear road ahead as to what the American healthcare system is going to be. President Elizabeth Warren would give you an entirely different roadmap. How do you invest when you don't know in a few years how the American healthcare system is going to work?
Yeah. And so you hear, I think different investors have different lenses on this. You know, I think honestly, my lens as an investor is I try to be pragmatic, right? What is the world that we live in today? Right. I don't think the healthcare is a conservative industry, right? It resists change. And so a lot of the changes that have been proposed could have beneficial effects. You know, a lot of them, you know, could create challenges for other subgroups of the population. And so, you know, I think my thesis has always been, you know, we have an existing healthcare system. Find companies who can make money in the world that we have, right? And that can also make money in a world of where value is more tightly associated with care, right? Today, it really is still mostly fee for service, right? You're getting paid for an activity. And so you have to be able to make money for the activity. Otherwise, if the world doesn't change dramatically, the company will not survive. But, you know, I'm only interested in investing in companies that can make money in a fee-for-service world, but can also make money when value really comes home to roost in healthcare, which, you know, it's got to come at some point. People were talking about it coming even a decade ago. It really hasn't happened yet. You know, how quickly that materializes, I think no one can say with any confidence. But, you know, being able to find a value proposition, you know, and I look at remote patient monitoring, I think is a wonderful example there, to where, and we're investing in this space. I would love to find more companies in the space, but where you can get paid by Medicare for doing monitoring of a patient remotely, right? There are existing codes. The codes are getting better year over year. You know, more companies are coming into the space, but remote patient monitoring should enable better outcomes, right? It should enable less people walking into the doctor's office. It should enable less visits to the ER. If it doesn't do those things, right? If the company and the application that they've chosen don't deliver outcome benefits, then it's not going to be a good investment. But in the world that existed a couple of years ago, an investor had to fund all of the clinical studies to do that before they would get any revenue. No one would buy the technology until you actually had clinical data. Right now, the world has changed, right? Regulations have changed, and so you can get paid some for the monitoring. And then you can spend, and hopefully the companies that I'd love to talk about or love to talk to are the ones who are then using that time and that revenue to be able to really demonstrate how their product makes a difference in the world.
Are the regulators getting easier to work with? Are we beginning to see, or are they beginning to see, that in order to encourage interesting developments in the world of medicine, that maybe not fewer regulations, but there needs to be a more friendly approach to disruption, to use a word you don't like?
I think there are pockets. And remember, I like disruption in the context of the original use,
sure,
right, of being able to serve that underserved population. But I think there are examples. You know, I think it's always a risk reward issue, and it's, and you know, FDA obviously is a part of the government.
Well, and if they screw it up, people die.
Yeah, yeah, and so they never want to get too far on the side, yeah, of being open to more risk. But I think places like, how do you think about an AI algorithm, right? Which by its nature, a machine learning algorithm is designed to get smarter, right? You feed more data into the algorithm, it gives you better decisions. You know, FDA has never dealt with that kind of software before, and its process, the previous process for how do you improve a piece of software, is very onerous. And so I give them a lot of credit for trying to figure out ways to regulate an AI algorithm so that you don't have to freeze it, right? And you pump more data through that, you pump more real world evidence through that algorithm gets better. Do you have to then wait two, 3 more years before that algorithm can be used with patients? That would be terrible, right? That'd be awful for patients. And so FDA is trying to think about, you know, I don't think they have all the pieces there yet, because as you said, you know, they don't want to expose themselves to undue risk, and they don't want to expose patients to undue risk. But the idea of how do you regulate a piece of software which is living, right?
The minute the FDA regulator walks out the door, the software is different.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
And how do you regulate that appropriately, right? I think is really interesting, and they're being quite thoughtful and innovative on that. And I think the other area is software as a medical device, right? In the same, you know, they're used to regulating hardware devices, right? Where a change in that might be a multi-year process. You know, software, right? Even if it's not an AI algorithm, you might rev a piece of software every day, every month.
Well, right, because I mean, the average, you know, Nest developer or Ring or, yeah, whatnot, hey, we're going to push out, yeah, version 2.1. You know, it'll be seamless. The homeowner will, yeah, never notice. You can't do that with medical software.
Yeah, absolutely. And how do you figure out what is the cadence that's appropriate for, you know, more direct intervention, right, supervision, versus what can be pushed by the manufacturer as a process of continuous improvement? I think that's another area. Software as a medical device, or SAMD, is another area where I think FDA is being quite forethoughtful there.
On about a fifth grade level, explain the new technologies to me. What has changed that has changed the face of developing new healthcare ideas, investing in healthcare, that kind of stuff?
I think compute, right, is a huge impact, right? And I think can go a lot greater than a fifth grade level. A lot of these folks that are on your audience, and a lot of the folks that,
sure,
and you and others, you know, I think everyone appreciates how powerful, you know, big data and AI technologies have become. And frankly, I think they're slow to come to healthcare, right? Healthcare is regulated, it's conservative. It's a real challenge to bring some of these new technologies in. And therefore, I think there's a lot of places of intersection where technologies that have frankly been developed in other vertical markets, right, and have started to have an impact in those vertical markets, are just now coming to healthcare, or even not yet coming to healthcare, because it's just more difficult to from a stakeholder perspective. Instead of one customer, right, you have many stakeholders, right? You have patients and doctors and regulators and payers, you know, who in some of our markets, you know, are the same person, right? There might not be regulation, right? The customer might be the person who's actually, the user might be the person who's paying for the technology. And in healthcare, that's often not the case. And so that means that it's...
Of how AI or big data has changed the way that we're doing healthcare?
So I think it's still really early days, right? I think that... In some sense, you know, AI has been in life sciences for a number of years, since the advent of genomics, right? I mean, I think the ability to manipulate genome scale data, right, is basically impossible without sophisticated algorithms and machine learning, right? You're just getting too much data. And so back in the 90s, when I first came into healthcare, you know, they were already starting to use machine learning and AI as part of the drug discovery process. And the first drugs that have been touched by genomics are now starting to come to the clinic. So it's having an impact there. But in terms of frontline care, you know, I think AI is still at the very earliest stages of touching, you know, of touching actual patients, you know, right in front of them, right? But things like AI to do radiology examinations, AI for pathology, AI to triage patients, you know, and identify those patients at greatest risk that need the most care. You know, we have lots of systems, lots of manual systems in healthcare, right? And my belief is that that AI technologies will not replace physicians, right, but will augment them and allow them to spend time actually person to person, right, while these technologies make it more efficient for them to spend their time with the people who need them the most.
You got somewhat specific about AI for in an ER, that kind of thing. You know, speculate for me, or maybe there are companies that you're already working with and what they're working on. But 10 years from now or 5 years from now, I walk into the doctor's office, I walk into the ER or whatnot. What am I going to see or do in which I say, oh, that's what's happening. There's where the computing power is.
Yes. Well, I think, first of all, hopefully you'll walk into the doctor's office or the ER a lot less. Right. Because today, you know, a lot of the costs are people going to the doctor's offices when they don't need to. Right. And so one of the examples is being able to do more remote patient monitoring. Right. To be able to put sensors on a patient's body or to allow them to use sensors from devices that they already have, like their cell phone or their wristwatch, to be able to collect information to know which patients who perhaps are recovering from congestive heart failure or perhaps are at high risk of a stroke. You know, those patients who really are going to need intervention, right, and escalated intervention, and ultimately end up in the physician's office. You know, but those patients who don't necessarily need the intervention can go around and live their lives, you know, and maybe interact with a chatbot or maybe interact with a physician asynchronously, you know, or maybe go into a schedule appointment that maybe gets accelerated by a couple of weeks, but not necessarily end up in the emergency room, right, where the cost of care rises really dramatically.
I realize you're working with startups who are very excited about the future, but do you get pushback from the medical community? I know the legal community is deeply concerned about yep. AI. What about the medical community?
Absolutely. I mean, I do think I'm a big fan of thinking of the A as augmented, you know, rather than truly artificial, right? I believe in the human in the loop intervention, right? Technology and service combined. Right, I think those are where most of the advances are going to be made. And I think that makes physicians feel a lot better, right? That human judgment, being able to have a artificial intelligence or an algorithm can only recognize things that it's seen before, right? It's not, these things are not good at taking completely novel information and knowing what to do with it, right? That's where human judgment is important. And at least in the near term, I think the number of corner cases, the number of edge cases, the number of things that are just a little bit different, right, are sufficiently high that the risk of replacing humans is extreme. And so the ability to then couple it with a physician, I think, makes physicians feel a lot better. You know, I think being able to show that it's well validated. Eric Topol wrote a recent book about the potential for the use of AI in healthcare. I think there's some really great things. I recommend that to a lot of people that I talk to. You know, of being able to, you know, allow physicians to exert more empathy, right, to spend their time with people, you know, instead of punching stuff into the EHR, which they do a lot of today. Right, but also to ask the algorithms to be more validated, right, to put them through the paces of understanding all of the possible corner cases before deploying them clinically. Yeah, I think those two things are going to happen for these technologies to make a big difference in care.
Big data and AI have been trendy lately, and it does seem to be this belief that, well, computers and big data and AI will just throw that at it,
yeah,
and it will solve our problems.
Yes.
It doesn't matter what the problem is. But it does seem like medicine is something that lends itself to this, because medicine is so much about measurable data. I mean, when a nurse or a doctor comes into the room, they're taking data, blood pressure, weight, response time, that kind of stuff.
Absolutely. So you're getting a lot of data, but I also think there's a lot of things that aren't being fully reduced to data, right? So I think it is a great, it's grist for the mill, right? This information is critical for collecting and for making decisions on. But as examples, you're not collecting, if you're just collecting data in the doctor's office, you're missing a ton of data about that person's life, right? A person sitting in a doctor's office feels differently. You know, it's only, it's a, their blood pressure is different often in the doctor's office than they are at home, right? You're not catching variations in weight or in respiration that might be present in their home life. And so I feel like the you can get fooled sometimes into thinking you have enough data when, you know, A, you might need more data, right? But B, you might need a lot of other things that don't show up in the health record today, right? Social determinants of health are a big one. Access to care, you know, the concern about algorithms being too, you know, frankly, too focused on white males and not enough on people of color or women or people from underrepresented communities, right? All these things are places where, you know, an algorithm can have bias. You know, when I think the most surface way to think about it is, oh, just, you know, look at the data and everything will be okay.
More people are aware of this now, that so much of a medical research and so much of drug delivery and so much of treatment policies, et cetera, come from an average white male. Not the doctor.
Yeah.
The patient is assumed to be,
yes,
an average white male, which means as we get into these companies that run on algorithms, we're going to have to feed it data that is not just the average white male.
Absolutely. I think that's one of the big issues in the genetic databases that have been created, right, is that they tend to be disproportionately white males. Right. I'm Asian, born here in the U.S., but as an example, you know, there are different genetic diseases that are prevalent in Asians. There are different prevalences of different conditions, you know, and the genetic databases that have been created, are some of them are not representative, you know, of my background. Right. And that's true for everybody. Right. And so the ability to be able to exclude bias from these data sets, right, is really a function of sampling, right? You have to go out there and collect from these communities. And so there actually are some quite interesting startups that are trying to increase the input of data from different communities that really represent the population that we're trying to provide healthcare for, right? Healthcare should be for everyone.
Greg Yap, partner at Menlo Ventures. Sandhill Road is produced by Sean Myers, executive produced by Sarah Bueno and Stephanie Adruni.